From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with one of the creators of the Bossa Nova, Brazilian composer Antonio Carlos Jobim. Also today, we meet writer Harry Cruz. He writes about freaks and at times has felt like one himself. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of compositions by arranger and trombonist Rod Levitt. And television critic David Bianculli previews the new PBS series on Joseph Campbell, the man who spent a lifetime studying the role of myth in our lives. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Girl from Ipanema is one of the songs that started the bossa nova craze in the United States. The song was written by my guest, the Brazilian composer Antonio Carlos Jobim. He also wrote most of the bossa novas, which endured long enough to become pop and jazz standards. They include Desafinado, One Note Samba, Corcovado, Wave, Gingy, No More Blues, and How Insensitive. In a few minutes, we'll hear something from Jobim's first album in 8 years. Jobim was the bossa nova's leading composer. João Gilberto was its leading interpreter. Jobim and Gilberto teamed up with tenor saxophonist Stan Getz on a 1964 album. The Girl from Ipanema was the most popular song on the record and made it to number 5 on the pop charts. Jobim, the composer, was featured at the piano. Guitarist João Gilberto sang the lyric in Portuguese, and Astrid Gilberto sang a chorus in English.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que um poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, por que tudo é tão triste? Ah, a beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes.
Antonio Carlos Jobim, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you have any memories of writing Girl from Ipanema?
Yes, that was long ago. I still have some memories. She's a beautiful, beautiful girl. She used to pass by, you know, go to the beach, you know. Ipanema was a beautiful place. A few people, you know. The sand was so clean, you know, fine. The sea was so blue, green, you know, with the fish and the beautiful girls, and it was very nice, you know. And she is still a beautiful woman, you know. The other day I saw her, and she's beautiful. She was the prettiest, you know, the most.
This is a woman you knew and still know.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think when you started writing bossa novas, the bossa nova was seen as a pretty revolutionary music form.
Yes.
In Brazil, what was the revolution about? What made it so different from the music that had been played and sung before?
Yes, it was more like the to make a comparison, it's more like the cool jazz, you know, at the time, you know, with less. How do you say, economic, concise, succinct, with less, you know, the percussion and the rhythm, more to the point, you know, to avoid too many beats, too many notes, you know, this kind of music that was called, you know, revolutionary, you know. They thought this was a revolution, you know. As Stravinsky said, you know, a complete revolution, you know. You come exactly to the same point.
So who was angry at this new music? Who didn't like it?
Well, the Puritans, you know, the purists, you know, the guys that used to write about the traditional samba, you know, they thought that this was Americanized, you know, which is not true, you know. Now we can say that bossa nova is very much, you know, can be called jazz, you know, because everything that swings, you know, we call jazz, like, you know, Latin jazz, Caribbean jazz, Brazilian jazz, Cuban jazz, you know, this is very, the word jazz is very ample, huh? Very.
Yeah, but at the time, calling it jazz made it seem like a bastard kind of form of Brazilian music. Was that part of the problem?
Yes, yes.
So,
by the way,
yeah,
we have in Brazil, here I don't know, we have no bastards, you know, because this every son is legitimate. There is no bastards.
So who are the people who really loved this new music?
Chiefly the kids, you know, chiefly the kids, the young people, you know.
And how old were you when you started writing it?
I was, let me see, I was about 20, 25, 28, 32, 35 I came. Let's say the bossa nova explosion is when we came here to the States, the Foreign Service sent us here, and we played at the Carnegie Hall in November 22, 1962. And it was a big thing, you know. Bossa Nova was already well established in the U.S. of A, with, you know, the jazz musicians started to record the bossa nova consistently in the West Coast. And here in New York, Stan Getz with Charlie Bird, they recorded Desafinado, a song that I wrote that means off-key. You know, that was translated like slightly out of tune, which is not exactly the meaning of Desafinado. Desafinado means off-key.
I want to play another song that you wrote that was recorded by you, Stan Getz, and Joao Gilberto.
Yes.
In, what was this, the mid-60s, I guess?
Yes.
And this is Corcovado. And
yes.
You open this with some of your piano playing.
Yes.
And Astro Gilberto starts,
yes,
starts
yes.
with the singing. So let's give some of this a listen, and then we'll talk about it.
Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from my guitar, floating on the silence that surrounds us. Quiet thoughts and quiet dreams, quiet walks by quiet streams, and a window that looks out on Corcovado. Oh, how lovely. Um cantinho, um violão, esse amor, uma canção, pra fazer feliz a quem se ama. Muita calma pra pensar e ter tempo pra sonhar. Da janela ver seu Corcovado, o Redentor, que lindo.
quero a vida sempre assim, com você perto de mim, até o apagar da velha chama. E eu que era triste.
That's Corcovado from an album that really helped popularize bossa nova in America. It's the Stan Getz Wow Gilberto record, with songs mostly composed by my guest Antonio Carlos Jobim, who was featured at the piano, and Astor Gilberto opened with the vocal on that. You know, you were talking before about how radical bossa nova was perceived as being in Brazil when you first started writing bossa novas. In
yes.
America, I think it was seen very differently as a kind of quiet alternative to rowdy rock and roll and to loud and abrasive modern jazz and avant-garde jazz.
Yes, yes.
Did you feel that contradiction was true?
Yes, very much, yes. Well, you see, no one is a prophet in his own country. You know, the Bible says that, you know. When you do something different, you know, many people, you know, it's amazing how soft, you know, delicate songs can cause this reaction, you know. But this reaction came from a minority, you know, of critics that were, you know, like very, you know, preoccupied with what is authentic, you know.
You're talking about the critics in Brazil.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the critics here have been very, very nice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You've been a very generous people, you know, towards many, many things, you know.
Well, I read that you said once that if the bossa nova hadn't caught on in America, you think it just would have been stifled in Brazil.
Yeah, I think it would have disappeared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so strong, you know. Now in Brazil, they are giving me, you know, all these medals and things, you know, with the, you know, the album Passerine now is the best album, the album of the year. I'm the composer of the year, and I'm, I don't know, three awards, you know. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be there, so I'm sending my son to receive these awards. There is, you know, they say that if you stick around long enough, you will die with the breast full of medals, you know. If you die too young, you know, then you won't have time to get the medals, you know. So you should stick around a little longer, you know.
One of the leading interpreters of your songs has been Joao Gilberto. Are you still in touch with him? We heard him performing earlier.
Yes. He performed here a few days ago.
Oh.
Very good, very good. He's still in great shape, you know. He takes good care of himself.
Well, how did you both meet up? You were the leading composer, he the leading interpreter.
He came from the backlands of, you know, between the state of Bahia and Pernambuco. And he came to Rio de Janeiro and started singing there. He comes from a vocal group, you know. One of these vocal groups, you know, and then we tried to do a record, and nobody wanted to do a record with João Gilberto because he was considered too revolutionary, you know, too modern. Everybody would say this is very good, but it's not commercial, you know. So finally, we got the permission to make a 78, you know, with him, you know, a single. And the record did very well, so we got the permission to make an album. And I did an album, you know, with João Gilberto, that was very successful. And then the second album and the third album. And now, you know, he is his famous singer, you know. He was also accused of being desafinado, you know, of being off key. He's very much in key, but at the time, you know, because he sang this song, this off key, you know, called Off Key, the critics also started to say that he had a very beautiful voice, but that he was, you know, off-key, which is not true.
My guest is composer Antonio Carlos Jobim, who is one of the leading composers, really one of the first composers of the style now known as the bossa nova. We're going to talk more and hear something from his new record after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Antonio Carlos Jobim is my guest. Bossa Nova was such a big craze in America, and then like many crazes, it kind of quieted down. Was there any bad periods for you where there wasn't much demand for the music anymore?
Never.
Never?
Never happened that. I think that my songs are...
Well, your songs are still standard.
I think they are going to survive me, you know, by far, you know. They're going to survive me for sure because... They keep on recording, you know, the songs, and I feel, you know, for terra firma, you know.
Mm-hmm. I want to play something from your new record, and the new record's called Passerim, and we're going to hear the title song. But before we hear it, do you think that your style of songwriting has changed over the years? Do you think that these bossa novas are very different from the earlier ones that we heard a little before?
Yeah, you know, Terry, for me, you know, the word bossa nova is becoming like a burden, like a heavy cross, because, you know, I write a symphony and they call it bossa nova.
Right.
I write a waltz. Anything that I do, you know, a prelude or I write a tango, they call it bossa nova, because bossa nova actually means, you know, new flair. And it's like the La Nouvelle Vague, you know, the new wave.
Right.
New wave, Nouvelle Vague. So the bossa nova. Now the guys, they want to call it, you know, the nova bossa nova, the new.
the newly new.
I know that many of these crazes like, you know, the conga, the mambo, the you know, they come, they and go very. They have very ephemeral, very short life, short-lived, you know.
Yeah, they become like novelties.
Yes, like novelties that disappeared, you know. But I believe that Gershwin, Cole Porter, they are not going to disappear, you know, because it's more consistent, you know. There's something there, you know. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, let's play your new record and hear the kinds of music that you're writing now. And this is from a new album called Passerim on the Verve record label. And my guest is the composer Antonio Carlos Jobim, who's also singing on this recording.
Little bird on the tree, you better fly. If you stay on that tree, you're gonna die.
Little bird of the forest, say to me.
To rain, and now the rain has gone to stream. Where is my love, my long lost dream?
The ashes flew away and scattered far away.
And where is my love, little bird didn't say.
Antonio Carlos Jobim, this is really your first record released in America, anyways, in the United States. Your first record in the past, I don't know, several years. How come you waited so long to make another record?
I don't know. You see, the Passerine talks about fresh air, you know. It's an ecological song, you know, because man is destroying the environment so fast, you know, and this, we have to fight to avoid that, you know, not to kill the nature, you know, because we are part of it, and if we save nature, maybe we can save ourselves, you know.
Were you ever shy about recording or about performing, singing?
Yes, yes.
Specifically, what I mean.
Yes, I used to be, Terry, a background guy, you know, backstage, you know, always arranging. The first awards that I got, as arranger, you know, I've been sometimes nominated here in the United States, but I never got the first thing.
You're living in New York now?
Yes.
Is that part of the time or full time?
I'm living in New York. You know, I'm going to Brazil now. I'm back and forth all the time.
Was there a time when you were young and studying music when you thought you would be writing in the European classical tradition instead of writing, you know, pop music and songs?
Yes. I had a German teacher, you know, that fled from the war, you know, and he went to Brazil. And I had a kind of a classically trained, you know, to be a pianist, you know. But I think that popular music, you know, was really my thing. So finally, and also, you know, to live in Brazil, you know, as a erudite musician is difficult, you know, because it's not like Europe or the U.S., you know. I like popular music, you know. I like I'm all, you know, involved with this thing.
There's a time when you were ready to write in another language, so to speak.
Yes, it was another language, so to speak. I wrote I have a couple of serious, you know, what they call serious music, you know, what they call classical music, you know. But they are not very popular.
Well, what made you realize, though, you should be writing in your own voice, you should be writing in the rhythms of your own country, the rhythms that you grew up hearing?
Because here, you see, you have so many good musicians, you know. I lived 4 years in California. You have such, and New York, too. You have such good musicians. I would be just one more, you know, just one more jazz musician. So if I can bring you some fresh air from, you know, from abroad, it's more useful, you know. I will be servicing, you know, you better, you know.
Your first instrument is piano, but you also play guitar.
Right.
It's interesting to me. I think the kind of songs that you write are really more associated with guitar than with piano. Maybe that's because Gilberto was one of the performers who popularized the form.
Also, when I got to the States, they wouldn't let me play piano here. You know, they said, "Listen, Antonio, you gotta be the Latin lover. You should play the guitar. You know, if you play the piano, you destroy the whole image." You know, so I've been playing guitar for many, many years. You know, which was, let's say, my second instrument. That was an instrument that I used to play by ear, you know. I play a little flute, a little guitar, you know, and the piano was the, you know, the main thing, you know.
There have been some very silly bossa nova records made over the years.
Sure.
Trying to cash in on the craze.
Oh, sure.
Can I ask you which you thought were the silliest of the bunch?
I really don't know. You know, I don't worry much about the. There are so many silly things, you know, that as you well know, you know, I love, you know, the American music, you know, and Jerry Mulligan and Stan Getz and Chet Baker and, you know, so many, you know, my list, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, Billy Taylor, George Shearing, so many guys that you have here that they play bossa nova so well, you know, they can play anything, you know.
When you first started writing bossa novas, did you sit down and think to yourself, "I'm writing something new here"?
No, I was, you know, rather naive, you know. I was immersed, you know, in the this in the music thing, you know, music. I couldn't see, you know, I was very I was concentrating on my work, you know. I didn't have names for it, you know. I used this word on the back cover, on the liner notes for an album, talking about João Gilberto, you know. Talking about João Gilberto, I wrote, you know, João Gilberto is a baiano, a bossa nova. A baiano means a guy from the state of Bahia, you know. And I called him bossa nova, you know. And bossa nova means, you know, a guy that has a gift, a flair, and a new flair, you know. And that's it. And then this name got very popular, you know, bossa nova. And then suddenly in Brazil we had the bossa nova president, the bossa nova refrigerator, you know. This car is a bossa nova, you know. Anything new, anything new they would call a bossa nova, you know.
Let me ask you one thing about your new record. I noticed that there's a lot of Jobims performing on it. There's Paulo Jobim.
Right.
And Analentra Jobim.
Right.
Elizabeth Jobim. These are all your family members?
Yes, the family members. Also, we have other families there, like the Caymmis, you know. The Danilo Caymmi and his wife, that is Simone Caymmi. And we have the Morellenbaums, you know, Jacques Morellenbaum and Paula Morellenbaum. You know, all these are families of musicians, you know. I've been accused of nepotism, you know, but it's not true, you know. We've been working together because they're good, you know, and they were around, you know, so I could say, hey, guys, you know, come here, you know, let's work, you know, for a change, you know, instead of, I believe, you know, in life, in music. I believe that that music should lead you to happiness, not to, you know, that the kids should not kill themselves, you know.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Terry.
My guest has been composer Antonio Carlos Jobim, who was really one of the founding composers of the bossa nova. His latest record is called Passerine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director Robert Altman. He directed groundbreaking films such as MASH and Nashville, and is now working with cartoonist Gary Trudeau on the HBO special series Tanner 88. They're following the presidential campaign trail with fictional character Jack Tanner. I hope you can join us. Here's more music from Antonio Carlos Jobim's latest record, Passerine.
Isabella, wake up, the sun is coming through the window. We're riding with the sun, I feel your heartbeat. The morning light plays in your eyes, with floating blue and white skyline. A city in the skies for Isabella. We're gazing through the clouds, we sail the windrows. The break of day sparks my desire, and ocean waves won't quench the fire. We kiss, we're high like gliders in the sky.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet writer Harry Cruz and enter his world of midgets, sideshows, sleazy bars, and junkyards. His new novel is about a boxer who knocks himself out. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead examines the work of arranger and trombonist Rod Levitt. A few of Levitt's compositions have just been reissued, and Kevin says that could be just the thing to make jazz fans discover him. And television critic David Bianculli previews Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth, a new public television series devoted to the man whose work inspired such diverse tales as Watership Down and Star Wars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Secretary of State George Shultz went to Capitol Hill today to brief members of Congress on the agenda for the Moscow summit and to try to persuade senators to ratify the INF treaty before the summit starts. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Secretary Shultz said it would take the edge off the summit if the Senate fails to ratify the INF treaty before President Reagan goes to Moscow, describing the more than 70 hearings and 1,300 questions the Senate asked about the accord. Shultz argued that there is a time to inquire and a time to vote. He then made the point that the vote will not be close when ratification eventually occurs, that the Senate is turning down the amendments put forward by conservative senators by more than 90 votes. But there seems so far to be no inclination on the part of treaty opponents to speed up the process. They do not want the president to use the INF Pact as a starting off point for further arms control negotiations with the Soviet Union. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Reagan today tried to play down speculation that he wants an agreement on removing Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega from power before the Moscow summit next week. He sent State Department envoy Michael Kozak back to Panama today to continue negotiations with Noriega. But the president cautioned reporters at the White House that we're not going for time, we're going for quality. Mr. Reagan did not deny reports that he is willing to drop drug charges against Noriega in exchange for his resignation as the head of Panama's defense forces. A Colombian airliner hijacked today by a man who said he is terminally ill has taken off again after 2 hours on the Caribbean island of Aruba. An airport spokesman says the plane may be headed for Cuba, but he estimates that it does not have enough fuel to travel the 700 miles northwest. The hijacker, a man in his 30s armed with grenades, let 131 passengers and flight attendants off the plane in Medellin, Colombia, before ordering it first to Panama and then to Aruba, demanding a $100,000 ransom. Classes were canceled today at Hubbard Woods Elementary School in the Chicago suburb of Winnetka, the scene of Friday's shooting spree which left one student dead and six people wounded. Greg King of member station WBEZ reports.
Classmates of 8-year-old Nicholas Corwin attended his funeral services today. Second grader Alex Holtz says he's going to miss his friend.
I thought he was a very good friend of mine. He's a friend of many other people, too.
After the funeral, a memorial service was held at the school. Meanwhile, doctors at Evanston Hospital, where four of the students who were shot are being treated, report that each child is doing better. Psychiatrists say the next task will be to restore that sense of safety and security for these and other school children. For National Public Radio in Chicago, I'm Greg King.
A coalition of 17 surrogate mothers, including Mary Beth Whitehead Gould, launched a campaign today to try to force commercial childbearing operations in 12 states out of business. The day after a television movie about the Baby M case, Whitehead Gould said surrogate motherhood does not solve the problems of infertile couples.
It really doesn't solve their pain either. They're still infertile. Us giving us them, there are babies, it doesn't solve their pain. I think it puts a Band-Aid on it, and I think years down the line, they're going to have more pain than just being infertile.
Whitehead Gould refused to give her infant daughter to Baby M's biological father, eventually being forced to surrender the child but winning visitation rights. Today she called last night's TV movie about the legal battles inaccurate. Both sides are expressing cautious optimism as producers and striking writers meet in Los Angeles. This is the third time in the 12-week walkout the two parties have met with a federal mediator. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 11 points, closing at 1941.48. Declines led advances in trading of 102 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz trombonist and composer Rod Levitt has never been a major star, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he is a major talent. Levitt played in Dizzy Gillespie's band in the late 50s. He performed and recorded with arranger Gil Evans and has written for bandleader Peter Duchin. The music Kevin's reviewing was originally from some albums Levitt recorded in the early 60s. This is a Levitt composition called Vera Cruz.
One of the joys of listening to jazz for a living is stumbling across wonderful old music everyone seems to have forgotten. There's a new CD sampler out called the RCA Victor Jazz Workshop, The Arrangers, most of which consists of 1956 recordings by Hal McCusick and Johnny Carisi. But tucked away at the end of the program are five 1964 tracks by trombonist Rod Levitt and his orchestra. Actually, it's a big-sounding octet with pianist Cy Johnson and the Swedish trumpeter Rolf Eriksson. Levitt is not well known nowadays. He doesn't turn up in the history books. And those five tracks were my introduction to his music. Hearing them made me an instant fan and made me wonder how so splendid an arranger and so striking a player could have fallen into obscurity. His trombone sound is enormous. On Mr. Barrelhouse, a tune which slips neatly from 4/4 swing to waltz time and back again, it's broad and slobbery enough for a circus band. Around the time he recorded these sides, Levitt cited Woody Herman's great trombonist Bill Harris and Ellington's plunger-mute virtuoso Tricky Sam Nanton as prime inspirations. Neither was a common influence in the early 60s, though Levitt's contemporary Roswell Rudd had come up with a somewhat similar mix. But while Rudd achieved justifiable fame, Levitt never did, either as player or composer. In the 50s, he'd written for marching bands and later played for shows at Radio City Music Hall. He'd obviously listened to Gil Evans and George Russell, too, but Levitt synthesized those strains into a complex style unlike anyone else's. His orchestrations could be subtle and finely detailed. The band's three saxophonists doubled on various woodwinds, and his pieces tend to evolve through a series of structures and textures. Often, they reflect the same exuberant streak as his trombone work. Here's Rod Levitt's Holler No. 3. The drummer is Ronnie Bedford. Thank you. I don't want to slight the other fine music on this new CD. The Gil Evans and George Russell arrangements Hal McCusick plays are interesting, if not their best. Hearing them in conjunction with Levitt's and Johnny Carisi's charts shows how profoundly Evans and Russell influenced a few of their colleagues. Still, it's the Levitt sides I keep going back to. He recorded four albums in the early 60s for RCA and Riverside. All are out of print and likely to remain so, but I've managed to track them down. While the five newly reissued pieces are certainly among his best, Rod Levitt's entire output is due for some upward revaluation.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Rod Levitt's music is featured on the RCA Victor Jazz Workshop, The Arrangers, on the RCA Bluebird label. This is Fresh Air. Harry Cruz has had a hard life, and he hasn't made it any easier for the characters in his novels. He writes about freaks and losers who have unusual gifts. Cruz has written 10 novels, essays, and a memoir called A Childhood about growing up on tenant farms in Georgia. His new novel is called The Knockout Artist. It's about a boxer who leaves rural Georgia to try and make it big in New Orleans. Here's Cruz reading the opening paragraph.
From where he sat on a low stool, the boy, whose name was Eugene Talmadge Biggs, but who was often called Knockout or KO or Knocker, had counted the suits hanging in the open closet three times. And each time he counted them, he came up with a different number. That did not surprise him. He was not a good counter. It was just something to do until it was time for him to go out and do the only thing he had left. Besides, nothing much surprised him anymore.
You know, as we get deeper into your novel, we understand that this boxer is about to fight for the pleasure of this wealthy man and his crazy friends, and that the boxer's specialty is actually knocking himself out by punching himself in the jaw. Did you actually know anybody who could do that, who could knock himself out by a self-imposed blow?
Well, strangely enough, I did. I don't think, however, it's what caused me to write the book, but I did. My brother was a professional fighter. He was 22-2 when he broke his right hand. And I spent a good deal of my early manhood in fight gymnasiums of one kind or another. And boxed as an amateur myself.
This character in your novel basically is forced to make his living through self-debasement. Do you know what I mean? Instead of really being able to use his talent of boxing, he has this vulnerable jaw. So he knocks himself out, and people relate to him because it's self-debasement. You know?
Let's get one thing clear.
Yeah.
He does do what he does, and if you want to call it self-abasement, that's fine. But he doesn't have to do it. Nobody's holding a gun to his head. The boy is doing what he is doing because he lost the only thing he could do, which was fight effectively as a professional, and then because he has people he loves very much who are counting on him for money to sustain them, namely his family back in Georgia, he being in New Orleans during this novel, he does this to make money, all of which he sends home.
Well, do you relate to his predicament?
Oh, do I ever.
So what are some of the things that you felt that you were forced to do that you didn't really want to do?
Oh, well, now we're on the radio, aren't we?
that bad?
No, not that bad. I suppose having to earn a living in ways that I would not elect to have earned that living for people who were looking for me for something to eat and a place to stay.
You know, critics always describe your novels as being centered around characters who are freakish or abnormal. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, all right, yes, certainly I would agree with that. For instance, there in the first three novels, there is a midget in all three novels. A different guy, but a midget in each of the first three novels. They're very different people, but there are midgets, and there are people who are deformed one way or another.
You know, I've just been reading your autobiography about your early life until you were around 6 years old. It's called A Childhood.
Yeah.
And from that book, I really get the impression that during part of your childhood, you really felt like a freak. You had polio when you were five, and your legs were just
well, yes,
bent.
My legs drew up until the heel was against the buttock. That is, the legs drew up as tightly as they could draw. And, yeah, I know what it's like to have people look at you and their face mirror your own rather dreadful circumstances, that is to say, your freakishness. And sure, I felt like a freak there. And I wrote about that thing, as you say, in A Childhood. But, of course, there were other times I felt freakish, too. Not just there, but other places, many other places. For instance, when I left the farm and went into the Marine Corps, here I am, a boy off a tenant farm in South Georgia, who, among other things, just one thing, I didn't know what a pizza was. Never heard of one.
No kidding.
Didn't know what pepperoni was. So I go to Paris Island in the Marine Corps in a platoon of boys from where? Well, New Jersey, New York, of course. And, well, everything about my speech, the idiom of my speech, was all wrong. And I felt very strange and was made to feel very strange. And as a matter of fact, if you let me pursue this for just a minute, it's one of the things that caused me to have such a very, very long apprenticeship when otherwise it may not have been necessary, because I wrote four novels and a rather large room full of short stories before I ever published anything. And the reason I didn't publish any of those things is because the stuff wasn't any good. And the reason it wasn't any good is I was trying to write about a world I did not know.
Which world was it, and whose voices were you trying to write with?
Oh, I was trying to write about people who had families and who grew up in the same house, and about people who, if they were unfortunate enough to have hookworm and rickets, were able to go to the doctor, and about people who knew about automobiles and not about mules. And so I take it as a moment of grace that one night very late when I was working, it for whatever reason occurred to me that whatever strength I had was all back there in Bacon County, Georgia, with all that sickness and, as I say, hookworm and rickets and ignorance and beauty and loveliness and the rest of it, such as it was. But that's where it was. It wasn't somewhere else.
Can I read you the inscription to your novel and ask you about it? You dedicate your novel to Rod and Debbie Elrod,
mm-hmm.
who made every effort to keep me sane and very nearly succeeded during the struggle to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
Were you having serious problems when you were writing the book? I mean, all writers talk about going insane while they're writing books, but was there something especially crazy that was happening to you while you were writing this?
Not any more so than has been true of the other books I've written, and I don't want to go on too much about it or make it sound too precious, and I don't think I suffer any more than any other writer does. I think some writers manage to live with what for me is the tension and the anxiety and the general scariness of writing a book. I think some writers manage all that better than I do. I never manage it very well. And my behavior takes various forms, or has in the past, when I'm writing a book. For the last, I don't mind saying this, everybody in this town knows it anyway, and most of the people who know me around the country know it. For the last 12 years, probably, I've been a really, really bad drunk. But it was a curious form of drunkenness. If I wasn't working, I wasn't a drunk. And then you say, well, no, wait a minute, that's stupid. You can't write and drink. Well, I know that. But I can stop writing and or get so scared or warped or twisted and stop writing and get drunk for 3 or 4 days and nights or 2 weeks and then stop drinking and go back to it.
We know you've alluded in one of your essays to thinking of yourself as someone who has to hold himself back from giving in to his worst impulses.
Yeah, and that gets right back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. I like the edge, or another way to say that is when things get too comfortable and things get too safe, I get the feeling like I'm smothering. It's like somebody's burying me in feathers. And so when things get too safe and too secure, then I have a tendency to start tearing things up or tearing things down, as the case may be. And but I, as I grow older, I seem to be doing better with all that, much to the relief of the people around me, I think.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, God bless you. It was my great pleasure, and I hope it was all right.
Writer Harry Cruz, whose new novel is titled The Knockout Artist. He spoke to us from station WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
So what story are you following?
Well, we're following the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, which Secretary of State Shultz today urged the Senate to approve as rapidly as possible. And we hear why it's been so difficult for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to agree on strategic arms reductions, which are the next step after INF. We also continue our look in this pre-summit week at Eastern Europe under Mikhail Gorbachev. We speak with reporter David Blow, who's in Budapest, where over the weekend the Hungarian party got a new leader. And we continue our look at events in Czechoslovakia. We hear about how human rights activists are faring there this year.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new Bill Moyers series starting this week on public television. It features conversations with the late Joseph Campbell. Here, Moyers tells how Campbell was first inspired to study the mythology and religions of various cultures.
When Joseph Campbell was a little boy, his father took him to the Museum of Natural History in New York, and he was transfixed by the totem poles and masks. Who made them, he wondered? What did they mean? He began to read everything he could about Indians, their myths and legends. By 10, he was into the pursuit that made him one of the world's leading scholars of mythology and one of the most exciting teachers of our time.
That's Bill Moyers, who is so excited about what Campbell has to say that he's giving him 6 hours of PBS airtime in which to say it. The series, which starts this week, is called Moyers, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth. Campbell, who died last year, devoted his life to the study and comparison of different mythologies and religions. Moyers, who interviewed Campbell the last 2 summers before his death, listens intently as Campbell distills a lifetime of learning into 6 astoundingly rich hours of TV.
Why myths? Why should we care about myths? What do they have to do with my life?
Well, my first answer would be, well, John, live your life. It's a good life. You don't need this. I don't believe in being interested in subjects because they're said to be important and interesting. I believe in being caught by it somehow or other. But you may find that with a proper introduction, this subject will catch you.
This is certainly the proper introduction. In the first installment, Moyers is quick to make the point that Campbell's insights were the inspiration for Star Wars, Watership Down, and other modern adventure stories. Almost every story Campbell tells is accompanied by visuals, but Campbell is such a warm storyteller that they're not really necessary. He's the Garrison Keillor of mythology, friendly, casual, and surprisingly entertaining. Campbell talks about all the things people usually shy away from in casual conversation. Life, death, religion, love. He finds meaning in everything, even in the act of marriage.
A marriage is a relationship.
when you make a sacrifice in marriage, you're not sacrificing to the other, you're sacrificing to the relationship. And this is symbolized, for example, in that Chinese image of the Dai Chi, the Tao, you know, with the dark and the light interacting. It's a well-known sign. That is the relationship of yang and yin, male and female, which is what a marriage is. And that's what you are. You're no longer this. You're the relationship. And so marriage, I would say, is not a love affair. It's an ordeal.
Individually, the stories he tells may not mean much, but piled on top of one another with all of their similar morals and concerns, the effect is mind-boggling. I should point out, too, that Campbell is no out-on-a-limb crackpot. His interpretations of religions are convincing, at least to me, and his central piece of advice in this six-week series is to concentrate on finding out what makes you happy and enjoy it.
I always tell my students, follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss?
Your bliss, where the deep sense of being in form and going where your body and the soul want to go. When you have that feeling, then stay with it and don't let anyone throw you off.
Moyers says that following his own bliss is what led him back to PBS, specifically to do this series about Campbell. He and producer Catherine Taji have produced a series that exemplifies what public television was created to do: present the people and ideas that truly mean something. Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth is, if you'll pardon the pun, not to be mythed. I know that's awful, but puns are my bliss.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow I'll speak with British writer William Boyd. His new novel follows the cinematic and political adventures of a monomaniacal filmmaker. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Funkadelics, a black psychedelic band whose roots were in doo-wop. And book critic John Leonard will review Dreamtime, Jeffrey O'Brien's meditation on the turbulence of the 60s. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.